From the studios of WICR at the University of Indianapolis, I'm Richard Brendan, and this is Journey's Fire. No one who lives and loves will be immune from grief and trauma. And while this suffering is universal, living through a devastating event often leaves people feeling alone and even alienated. Well, Michelle Neff Hernandez experienced this when her 39-year-old husband died after being hit by a car while riding his bicycle. Her most transformative realization was that grief changes us and that there's no going back or bucking up. Life is now different. She documents her grief journey in a beautifully written book that just came out. It's called Different After You, Rediscovering Yourself and Healing After Grief and Trauma. Michelle Neff Hernandez was also voted 2021 CNN Hero. She's a gifted speaker and a committed advocate for the widowed and bereaved. Her creation of Camp Widow and Soaring Spirits International has brought her global acclaim. Michelle regularly speaks to first responders, hospital workers, religious organizations, and diverse community organizations, and she's joining us from her home in beautiful Southern California. Michelle Neff Hernandez, thank you so much for being on the program today.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you for asking me.
Yeah. Well, this book is near and dear to my heart, given the almost 18 years of hospice work I've done. And as a chaplain and speaking on death and dying, but you clearly, for a lot of reasons, are the grief expert. And so I've really, really enjoyed this book. And I want to start off, I guess, for our listeners, what caused you or what led you to write Different After You?
Well, the story really began. First of all, thank you for those kind words, and especially thank you for all the work you've done in hospice. It is a sacred work, in my opinion. To answer your question, my own journey began with the death of my 39-year-old husband in a cycling accident. I was 35. We had a blended family of six, and we thought we had a long time together. And that accident changed the trajectory of our lives and led me to the work of having to rebuild my own life after my husband. And so that sort of took me on a journey of exploration, in part to learn how to manage this unwanted and crazy life for myself, and then secondly, to just sort of discover where would other people be who were living this sort of an experience. And so that led to a community, and I am so grateful to have been surrounded by people who loved and supported me, but none of them were with it themselves as they weren't sure how to be helpful or how to normalize some of the things that I was experiencing. So by going out and seeking other widowed people, which is what I ultimately did, and then having the experience of feeling hopeful in a way, nothing else made me feel hopeful, as hopeful as sitting in front of another widowed person who was making their way through. So after a number of interviews with other widows, thinking that what I was going to do was collect these stories and write a book, this was very early in my grief journey. So this book idea came to me very early on, but ended up being a very different book than I would have written at that time. So led me to, you know, meet all of these different people and think, gosh, wouldn't it be great if they could all come together in community? And so what I ended up doing was beginning a community, a peer community for widowed people called Soaring Spirits International, which has provided supports, resources, programs, and community for over 4 million widowed people since our inception, which, of course, at that time I had no idea. Like, all I wanted to do was find another widowed person who could tell me that that it was going to be okay somehow, even though I could not imagine that for myself. And so the roots of this book, of Different After You, really were born 16 years ago in those early days of me trying to figure out, how do I build a new life when I really loved the life I had?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you write in your book early on that it was 15, 16 years in the making. I have to ask you, being around death a lot like I am in some of the work that I do, it's one thing when you're told that your loved one, your spouse, for example, has cancer, in 6 months or less, and maybe they do, maybe it's longer. Your husband died suddenly while he was out doing what he loves. What was, first of all, how did you hear the news?
I was at home making dinner, and I got a call. And at that time, caller ID was a new thing, and I looked over at the caller ID and thought, that looks like a cell phone number. I'm not sure if I'm going to answer that. And then, for some reason, because it was a cell phone number, I decided, I better pick it up. And it was a woman, a very kind woman from the side of the road, calling to tell me that my husband had been hit by a car.
Oh. So she was there.
I believe that she came up on the accident.
Yeah.
So many people witnessed it. It was sort of at rush hour, 5:30 in the afternoon. And so a lot of people stopped. And she was came over to see if she could offer any support. And my husband's friend, who was riding with him, asked her to call me.
Okay.
And so the thing was that, my, as you said, when you're unprepared for news like this, your brain does funny things. And so what my brain told me was, oh, this lady's calling me to tell me that he got hit by a car. That must mean he broke his legs or something.
Right.
In no world did I think he was going to die.
Sure.
I thought, uh-oh, he's going to be really mad because he can't run next week.
So when you get the word that he died, and here you are making dinner, and you're making dinner for the kids also?
I am. I was making dinner for the kids.
I'm trying to put my head in that place, and I can't imagine dealing with all of that in that moment.
Yeah. I basically ran out the door, yelled over my shoulder at the kids, here's what's happening. And honestly, because I still thought it was going to be fine, I said to them, he probably just broke his legs. I'm going to go get him. And I called a friend and said, they're going to come and stay with you. It'll just be a few minutes. So I'm walking out the door, calling my friend saying, this is what's happened. Can you please come here to the kids? I get in the car, I'm driving up. And then, then the whole world turns into a completely different place.
Yeah.
For me, for the kids, for everyone who, who loved Phil, everything was in totally different. And from that moment forward, it was about learning how to both process my grief and also figure out how to create a life, because the one I had completely upside down now, and every plan, the thing about grief, I think, is, and this is true if you have a sudden death or a long-term illness, is there's so many things that will no longer be an option. And they continue populating your mind as you move through each day. What's going to be an option and what's not. And, him not being present changed everything for what we had planned for our future.
Yeah. The subtitle of the book really says it all, Rediscovering Yourself and Healing After Grief and Trauma. You mentioned just a few minutes ago, though, had you published this years ago when you started to write, it would have been different. How so?
I wouldn't have had the perspective of all of the other people that I've met. And so this book, actually, in a deeper answer to your first question, the reason I wrote this book, especially this particular book, is that one of the widowed people that was at a program we were holding had been many times and came up to me and said, Michelle, I have a question for you. I need you to answer me. When am I going to be back to myself?
Yeah.
When am I going back to the old me? And I realized, my first response was, never. And I realized that was going to be a sad answer for her, because she couldn't see what I could see.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't able to see the survivor that she is as valuable. Instead, she was seeing the survivor she is as less than because of the trauma that she lived through.
Yeah.
And so I devised right then for her, for that one person, I created a workshop about learning to love the new me.
Mm-hmm.
And then started collecting these just stories and perspectives of all of the different people I've met, and beginning to understand what the steps were that we kind of need to process through to get to a place where we can own our new selves and really step into our fullness of living through something really tragic.
Yeah. Yeah. So as you're exploring yourself, having to now deal with something so deep, and the grief, I'm sure, was so hard, you invited other people along, got their input and such, and then that's how things began to grow. How did you handle the grief with all the children that you had?
Yeah, that's really one of the most challenging parts of grief if you're also parenting children, is just the fact that each of them can only understand it in their particular way at their age and their developmental understanding, which means you're going to revisit a lot of times.
Yeah.
And so we had six kids, you know, aging in range from 23 to 11. And because we're a blended family, we also had, you know, other family dynamics included in that. And so the older three were 23, 21, and 17. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, they have a different understanding than the 14, 13, and 11-year-olds.
Sure.
And as we kind of grew through that as a family, each one of them also, it became clear to me they each had their own grieving personality as well. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, adapting to each one of those personalities and understanding what they needed from me as a parent and what they needed for themselves as a grieving child, and then knowing that that was going to, I didn't know at the time, but what I know now is that that would continue to evolve. Mm-hmm. What they would need from me would continue to evolve. What they would understand would continue to evolve. And so it's a challenge as a parent, because on the one hand, you understand this experience and can kind of see into the future of what it's going to mean. But for the kids, they are only really seeing it from their vantage point right this minute. And so it's harder for them to imagine those times in the future where they're going to have to revisit. And so, you know, especially in the event of an accident, their understanding of the accident and what really happened, you know, they came to that questioning later. They wanted to know more details later when they were older and were trying to process, you know, that this had happened to our family.
Yeah.
So I'm always just really sending a lot of love and encouraging widowed parents to have a support network, because, you know, parenting grieving kids while grieving yourself is really hard work.
Oh, it certainly is. And don't you find it's almost impossible to get the healing that you want trying to do it by yourself?
Yeah, I believe that's really true. And the way I think of it is, you know, we talk about me, myself, and I. And if me, myself, and I are all in my head and we're the only ones weighing in on any grief-related experience or feeling, you know, there's no additional perspective. There's no way out of that circular kind of whirlwind that can happen in our heads. Mm. And the beauty of having a community is that we get this additional perspective. And that additional perspective allows us to have our grief normalized, to have access to additional resources that maybe we didn't know about, even just to be able to have a sense of understanding and just a little relief. Like I said, I didn't feel, the thing that made me feel the most hopeful was being in the presence of other widowed people who had somehow made their way through.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I'm sure you can always pick up an idea, suggestion that someone else has used that's helped them, and put that in your toolbox, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And when you do, you have the opportunity then to explore something new, and you yourself and you get a little bit of relief. And I think that was the thing that, for me, community did, not only in my parenting, but in grief in general, was just, it felt possible to make it through when I experienced other people who had.
Well, the thing about grief, I remember David Kessler has been a frequent guest on the program, and he shared an insight once. He said he figures no matter where you go, whoever crosses your path, even at a drugstore, a grocery store, chances are they're grieving over something.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yet so many people aren't. Yeah, and so many people don't really know what to do with that.
Yeah, and I think the other thing about it is that it can be scary, because when we're unfamiliar with the feelings of grief and when we have to face the reality that we can't fix this, there is no fixing. And I think that reality for people is really frightening, because for me, my go-to way of managing my life was to work hard. And so it was like, okay, well, if you want that thing, if you want this outcome, if you have to get yourself out of this situation, the way to do it is work hard. Mm-hmm. And I will never forget waking up and realizing no amount of hard work was going to undo this. Mm-hmm. He was dead, and I could not change it. Yeah. And so that's the reality that we end up having to come to terms with as a griever, no matter how much notice we had, even in the case of having a long time, and even in the case of feeling some relief for the person who died. Mm-hmm. You know, they're out of pain. They are, you know, they're done fighting the fight. Mm-hmm. And then you end up coming to the reality that now they're dead and there's no undoing that. And so that's one of, I think, the biggest challenges of understanding grief is that we're not really set up to address this impermanence, right? We have this sense that people are always going to be a part of our lives, even though we know for sure they're going to die. Every human is going to have this experience. We still struggle with that impermanence. Mm. and trying to figure out how do we continue to have a bond with this person who has died when it's going to have to be very different than what it was.
I'm glad you mentioned the word impermanence, because that's what comes to me, which I've learned from Buddhism, primarily, that when a loved one dies, it's a reminder of that, that nothing lasts forever,
yeah.
That we need to be holding on to everything lightly. We don't often, but it's a reminder of that.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's so scary.
Yes.
Because suddenly we realize that when you look around, everyone's going to die. And so it is that reality that continues to come back to us each. And that's one of the things I loved about writing the book, is that I could acknowledge that everything that we've lived through, and it's the good and it's the hard and it's the complicated and it's the wonderful, it makes up who we are. Mm-hmm. And if we allow ourselves to be changed by our experiences and to allow our past and in particular our challenging experiences to have a seat at our table, mm-hmm. at our mental table, at our emotional table, mm-hmm. we have access to everything we've learned through each iteration of experience.
Yeah.
It's when we try to separate ourselves from our past, and I think that a lot of what encourages that, right, is the fear. It's the fear that we have to face when we deal with impermanence. It's the pain that we have to face when we face grief that sometimes causes us to think, okay, well, let's just push that out of here. Push that aside. Let's not have anything to do with that, please. And so by doing that, though, we separate ourselves from the understanding that we gained through that. And I like to look at people who have come through a grief experience and thinking about the struggle of those early days and just realizing and acknowledging that you've made it through that part, and that what you learned about yourself and what you gained, even the things you leaned on in those early days to make mm-hmm. your way through, those are gifts that you get to keep for the rest of your life, assuming you allow yourself to be changed by the experiences you've lived. Mm-hmm. If we spend all our energy trying to push them out, then we don't have access to the same level of tools and resources that we would if we allowed ourselves to acknowledge, right, I lived through that. And because I did, I now know this, and I know this, and I understand, you know, with new perspective, the mm-hmm. impermanence. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, as you know, I'm positive that part of the Buddha's teaching, you know, is a part of the impermanence, allows us to even better embody the lives we have. But it's scary to think that, because we feel like, okay, well, if I agree that everything's going to die, then what?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I get that. So let me ask you, when a newly widowed person, or perhaps even someone who has recently had a traumatic experience, when they come to you for some advice, what's some of the first things that you share with them?
One of the very first things I always say is to be kind to yourself and to do your very best to treat you, yourself, as you would your closest friend who was living your same experience. Because what I have found is that even in grief, we often hold ourselves to these impossible standards. We decide that we're supposed to be fill in the blank. And oftentimes that's better, stronger, smarter, more able to manage, you know, the challenging experiences that we're living through. And we don't acknowledge how difficult what we're doing is and how that difficulty will change some things about us, especially in the short term. And so instead, like I in the book I talk about making baked chicken and forgetting the chicken. And, you know, so, but what I took away from that as a newly grieving person was that I wasn't as good as I used to be. Hmm. Instead of saying to myself, you are doing really hard stuff, lady, and you probably need to give yourself a little break, maybe order some chicken. Instead, it was like, okay, I can't even remember the chicken and baked chicken. I am a horrible version of myself. And so I always want newly grieving people to be kind to yourself, to acknowledge how hard this is, and to give yourself every grace as you make your way forward in a pattern that is not going to be straightforward. It can be forward, backward, sideways steps, you know, but this path, this sort of circuitous path that we take through grief, if we can give ourselves grace and try not to judge ourselves as less than we used to be, and instead have a willingness to get to know this new person who's emerged from this experience, we set ourselves up for a much more empathetic and really just enable our healing in a completely different way.
You know, I always find it fascinating. By the way, I love your response, be kind to yourself. I don't know how many people I've asked after the interview's over and we're still chatting on the phone before they hang up. Sometimes I used to ask them, and they might be talking about the environment or social justice or what have you. I would say, so, now that we're not talking about your book or what have you, what would you say the number one need is in this world? And they all say, we're not loving ourselves enough. We're not being kind to ourselves. And that's the message that Anita Moorjani has, who died on an operating table, crossed over, came back. Her profound message is that. It's hard for us to do that, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And when you think back to that young widowed person who's standing in front of me saying, when am I going back to myself? The whole message was, this self is unacceptable. I want the good me back. And so the message of this book is really about discovering and owning the you that was born through a traumatic experience and allowing the change that grief or trauma or both are bringing into your life to shape you instead of pretending like it doesn't. I think of it as like swimming upstream. If we pretend like we're not changed by grief, then we're just swimming upstream, trying really hard to heal, all the while fighting against the reality of we are changed. I always tell people it's as simple as this. The person I was before my husband died had never arranged a funeral. Now, if that is the only singular thing that I had done that was different, I am changed by that experience. The next time somebody else I know is planning a funeral, I have information that I didn't before. And if I decide that I want to use that information, I'm going to be able to help a friend of mine in a difficult time because I'm giving myself access to that experience that I lived through that was really difficult. Now, if I pretend like that didn't happen, I'm not going to be that person. I'm going to be fighting against those memories. I'm going to be pretending like that didn't happen in order to push it to the background. And so and that's just one tiny thing. That's one small reality that I knew, you know, and that really, just the other day, someone that I know had a friend whose loved one died in a cycling accident. And she was asking me the question about, you know, that she was going to see the coroner's report. And her friend had asked her if she would sit with her while she read it. And she said, do you have any idea what, you know, like, what am I getting in? Like, she was wanting to be present for her friend and also very afraid of what she was going to read. And I was able to talk a little bit about my experience with that and, you know, the likelihood of what she was going to see. And so my ability to lean into my experience, again, offered a resource to someone else who, to actually people who benefited from my willingness to say, this is what happened to me.
Yeah. And a big part of learning to be kind to yourself, and as you say, owning that, is also something that you write about, and that is, it takes patience, so you need patience.
And we are so short on that. I'm sure that you've noticed that.
Absolutely.
Well, and it's a part of the reason why I feel like we don't love each other, love ourselves well enough, because of the impatience of wanting to be something else, fill in the blank, wanting to be better at something, wanting to be have something different. You know, the discontent that we sometimes feel in our lives, instead of using that discontent to ask questions about what we need to create a meaningful life, oftentimes we use that discontent as a judgment against ourselves. And because we don't have the patience that's necessary to make our way through the healing process, which, as we know, takes as long as it takes.
Yeah.
There's no way to hurry it up. If you're hurrying it up, then likely what you're doing is pushing it aside. And what happens when you push it aside is that it's going to piggyback on something else and come back later. Mm. You know, it isn't something that we can escape from, because our experiences live in our souls, in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts, in our spirits. Mm. And because that's true, it's either we make peace with it, or we continue the journey of, you know, of delaying the time when we're going to process what we've lived.
Yeah. Yeah, I like what Tim B. Locke, who's a New York Times bestselling author of From Scratch, you've had a lot of people who've recommended this book, but she says this book, regarding your book, a beacon of light and hope, a gift to the world, and I couldn't agree more. It's a wonderful guidebook for people who are going through grief like we're talking about. I guess my question is, how soon, Michelle, after a life-altering loss or trauma, should someone pick up your book, Different After You?
I love this question because I've changed my mind about the answer. Who had asked me this right after writing it? I wrote this book with the intention of providing people who had sort of gotten past those early days and were starting to struggle with, who am I now? I wrote this with them in mind, thinking that the work might be too big or too not complex necessarily, but emotionally complex for people who were still in the midst of their grief. But it's, as in a personal note, my father died just a little less than a year ago, and he and my mom were married, and so my mom is now widowed, and so she, of course, as my mother, got my book and read it, and I said to her, I kind of tried to set her up for it, like, Mom, you know, just so you know, this is kind of for, you know, people who are further along. I don't want you to feel pressured, or, you know, just so you know, this is what was in my mind when I was writing it.
Yeah.
And after she read it, she said, sweetie, no, I think for anyone, she said, I know that there's some of this that I'm not ready for yet, but it is so helpful to know that that there is a path, and that when I'm ready to read it again, I may be reading it with different eyes.
Yeah.
And so I really loved that perspective. And I still stand by this idea that we do need to be emotionally ready to do this work and to do it without judging ourselves. So if you're not emotionally ready, there is nothing wrong with you. That just means that there's a little more emotional time that needs to kind of get through you. And I don't mean physical time. There's no way to know how long that is. But you'll know when you pick up the book, if it's calling to you, you're going to know that it's time to do that work. And if you pick up the book and you think, I can't even think about that, well, then it's not time yet. And so my hope is always that people would, you know, set that aside, put the book down, and then come back to it when, and, you know, check it every once in a while. Pick it up and think, okay, I want to read a different part of it. Okay, maybe I can do this right now. But I was really so grateful for the opportunity to have that perspective from my mom, of all people, to give us the sense that we don't, that it could be whenever you're ready. Mm-hmm. And maybe for some people that will be very early.
Yeah.
And for other people, it might be a longer time. And there's no right answer to that question. But I know for sure that when you pick up the book and you begin reading, there will be challenging parts. And I think that the challenging parts are the ones that are calling you to do a little more work.
Yes.
And so the other way of using the book is opening it, reading to a point until you feel like, okay, wait a minute, and then stop there. It's intended to be able to be reread. It's intended to be able to put it down and let it sort of marinate, think through, you know, consider the questions that are hard, and then come back for the next step. And I designed it that way intentionally with the hope that people could give themselves a break and not feel like, oh, this is a book I have to pick up, read through the whole thing, do all the work. You know, it's just not possible. It's going to take some time.
Well, it really isn't. And I appreciate that you write that to the reader to remind them this book isn't meant to be consumed all at once, because oftentimes we just need to ponder about some things in order it for to go, I often say, from our head into our heart, which is illumination. And so I love that you've created this book for that very reason. I think that'll be a big help. You know, the word integration is also a core part of your book. Can you tell us what you mean by that word integration in this context, and why you address it right away, up front?
I'd like to think of we all have heard the word integration, and it may mean a number of things depending on how you look at it, but from an emotional standpoint, in particular in a processing of grief and trauma, I like to think of integration as a three-legged stool. And the three legs on our stool are our past, our present, and our future. And when we are able to access every piece of our life, our past, our present, and then how we shape our future, we are in the most stable position we can be in for healing and for processing. What happens oftentimes is that we isolate one or another of those time perspectives because it's where we're most comfortable. So in particular for grievers, a lot of times the past is where we're most comfortable. So we spend a lot of time thinking about the past, living in the past, considering the past, processing the past, and what we, and that's normal and natural.
Yeah.
Same thing can be true in the present. If we are, let's say, caring for an ill parent or caring for young children who, as we know, take up all of your energy and all of your time in those early days when they're little, we can be very focused, present focused. You know, it's the only thing we can think about. We don't have time to think about the past. Who has, you know, no sense of the future right this minute? This is all I can do. And then when we're awaiting something very big and something very exciting, sometimes we can just be very future focused and, you know, waiting for a grandchild to be born, going on the trip of a lifetime, even waiting for a book to come out into the world.
Yeah.
I can say I spent a lot of time being future focused. And so it's natural to have a focus at different times on one or another time perspective. The troubles come along when we don't allow each one a place at the table. And when that usually happens, for someone who's lived through a trauma, is it's usually the past that gets kicked out, right? Mm-hmm. The bad thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And we would like to remove the bad thing so that we don't have to think about it and think only about what we're doing right now and what we might do in the future. But my favorite way to really express the value of this understanding of the past is, you know, many of us have watched a movie where somebody has amnesia, right? You wake up and you've forgotten everything about your past. You have no idea who you are. And, you know, they start creating a life. And then they can't figure out why when, you know, a certain sound happens, they jump. They can't figure out why a word or a phrase or something just keeps niggling at their brain or makes them feel anxious or makes them feel happy. Because without our past, we don't have any frame of reference for the present.
Yeah.
And we can't use what we've learned in the past to shape our future. And so the key for integration when processing trauma is having access to all three time perspectives. I use the example again of my dad's death. My dad had a very different death than my husband. He had a 6-month hospice experience, and for those 6 months, my whole family was able to care for him. Mm-hmm. It was an amazing gift, and I will always be grateful for that time. It was very different than what happened with Phil, and so. What I learned, though, in the aftermath of Phil's death and how I was changed by my grief really allowed me to be present for my family, allowed me to have thoughts of how best to help because of the work I do and because of the many experiences I've had with other grieving people. And so my past influenced the way we took care of my dad and also influenced what I knew was going to come for our future because I was able to have access to all of those things.
Yeah.
It's when we try to take one out that we end up, and for widowed people specifically, sometimes the future is too hard. We don't want to think about the future. The future I had is wiped out. I have no idea what my future looks like. And so we want to like remove that leg from our stool. And when you think about sitting on the stool, could you sit on the stool with two legs? Sure, if you have great balance. You know, you can imagine yourself trying to balance on two or even one leg. Could we do it? Probably possible. But how much energy would you put out doing that?
Yeah.
If instead you could have all three legs, you have this solid base on which you can sit to, you know, access every bit of your experience. And that stable base is where best we can address the processing of trauma and influence the way we heal.
The three-legged stool, I think, is a good example or a visual to think about, because my experience has been in working with people that nobody really wants to sit with the yuckiness of pain And which is what we really need to be doing to start kind of working through that. But we just kind of either want to go on really quickly or medicate it a little bit, even through healthy things, but we're not really feeling it at all. And that's important, isn't it?
It really is. And I mean, that's another example of this past, present, future triad, right? Is that if we try to remove ourselves from the present where all the pain is, then, you know, we've got to figure out where are we going, past or future. And oftentimes that's what happens, as you said, when we are not able to be in that pain. And you know, this is the thing, the beauty of integration is that we can use our past and our future as respites from the present. That's healthy. It's just that the present also needs to have a place. Each one of the time perspectives needs their place. And some days you're going to be more focused on one than another. That's totally natural. It's part of the ebb and flow of life. Mm-hmm. But what we have to do, though, is try to be cognizant of giving each a space. And so not running from the present all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Spending some time in the present, knowing how hard that is, feeling those feelings. And when it's time and you need a little break, you can either go back into the past and think, gosh, remember how great that was. Or you can think about the future and plan another trip or plan a way that you're going to, you know, redo the house again. Whatever it is that gives you an opportunity to have a respite from where you're struggling, that's normal. It's just that each piece needs to have its place. And when it does, we can provide ourselves those respites from the hard parts while also giving ourselves space for being in that really challenging. Mm-hmm. Like you said, it's the muck, you know. When we're in the muck of grief, it's really hard work, which is why we have to be kind to ourselves.
Yeah. You've gained a lot of insights on your grief journey, and you've created a 7-step process that you share in this book, Different After You. Can you share an overview of what that process is?
Yeah, this came to me just as part of the experience of, you know, thinking for myself of how do you come to rediscover yourself? And I think that one of the keys, the first thing for me was to acknowledge that you're different. And so for my little widowed person who said, when am I going to be the same? I had to say, you aren't. You can't be. And so that's the key, is starting there. We have to first acknowledge that we're different. And then we get, you know, I say it this way intentionally, we get the opportunity to grieve who we were. And for grievers, this, I think, is particularly important because it's natural to us to grieve the person who died. That makes sense. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes we don't give ourselves the opportunity to grieve the person we were. And so when I looked back at, you know, the person I was when I was married to Phil, I was, you know, the Pollyanna who was sure that hard work would get you everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I still miss that girl. She was great. But that's not who I am anymore. I know differently, and I look at things differently. And so, you know, I needed time to grieve the parts of me that were not going to be the same. And, you know, the beauty of integration is that I do get to keep all of those parts. Mm-hmm. But I first have to acknowledge that there's more to it than that now. Mm-hmm. And grieving that is an important step. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, once we've done that, I feel like we have to start asking the questions. And that's where the next steps of inventory, exploring possibility, and imagining come in. Because we have to ask ourselves, okay, be willing to ask the questions. Do I still like Mexican food? If my Mexican food was the food I ate with my person, that was what we ate all the time. Did I eat that because I like it? Did I eat like that because I like eating that with him? Did I like that restaurant? Would I pick that restaurant if it was just me? Uh-huh. These are the kind of questions to start asking about every part of your life, from where you live to where you eat to what you do to who you hang out with. And the answer might be yes. I love Mexican food, which I do, so that's true for me. But it could be no. So when you flip that question around and ask me whether or not I like to ride a bike, I do not. Uh-huh. And that is in part because of my experience, but the truth is I didn't love riding a bike in the first place. Yeah. I did it because I loved riding the bike with my husband.
Yes.
And when he was dead, yes, of course I have feelings about him dying on a bike, but even beyond that, to ask myself, Michelle, do you like bike riding? And if the answer is no, then this new me doesn't have to ride a bike. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just one of the changes that comes through beginning to understand what the new you might need.
There's nothing wrong with that. It's okay. I think a lot of people need that encouragement, don't they? They probably feel like, for example, if their spouse loved Mexican food and they didn't, well, I have to eat the Mexican food. It's in his memory.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is then we set, and this is where the kindness comes in again.
Mm.
You know, it's like we use torturing ourselves in ways large and small as proof that we loved our person. And if we can free ourselves from that and know deep down, we are always going to love our person and that the torturing ourselves is not necessary to prove it. The only permission we need is our own.
Yeah.
But it's the hardest permission to get.
Yeah.
And I honor that's hard. I don't want anyone to think that I'm saying that flippantly. If you have to struggle through the Mexican food question, then struggle through it. I just always want people to come to it from the place of, I am moving into a new space because I am a different person. What does my different person need? And right now, my different person might need to have Mexican food because it makes me feel close to my husband, even though it's not my first choice. But a year from now, I ask myself the question again, and I'm like, you know, I really don't like it.
Yeah.
Okay, but I go there on the anniversary of his death because even though I don't really like it, it still makes me feel like I'm close to him. Great. And now 2 years from now, I've changed my mind. On the anniversary of his death, I'm going to do something different. I don't want that Mexican food anymore. The only permission you need is your own. And so often, we make a statement, you know, the never always statements. I'm never, ever, 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 ever going to take off my wedding ring. And then one day you're like, gosh, I really would like to take off my wedding ring for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And then think, but wait, no, I said never. I was never going to do that. And so, again, whose permission do we need to make the change? Only ours.
Yeah. There's no right or wrong necessarily. Of course, I'm thinking now of this book on grief and the COVID pandemic we've been through, and people, so many people have experienced so much loss on various levels. What advice, Michelle, would you give to those people who are close to someone who's going through major loss?
It's a similar advice that I would give in the kindness arena. And it's twofold, actually. The first is that remembering that this experience cannot be fixed. And I think that's the most difficult thing for someone who is supporting a grieving person to accept fundamentally. You cannot fix this. And so then it's like, well, if I can't fix it, what am I supposed to do? Because we are trained to, act, to provide solace is an act. But what I want to remind people of is to hear someone and sit with someone in their grief is an act. And that the most kind thing we can do for someone is just be present for them in their pain.
Mm-hmm.
Because, as you said, when we're sitting in that muck of grief, it's lonely and isolating.
Yeah.
And if you're accompanied by people who keep encouraging you to get out of the muck, then you feel worse about yourself, especially if you feel incapable of getting out of the muck. And so what you really need is someone who's going to sit down next to you in the muck and not say anything. So now you're not alone in the muck. You're not being encouraged to do something that doesn't feel good or right for you. And you have somebody there just for you. And it's the hardest thing to do. So I want to say that if that's not you, if you're not a person who feels capable of that, there are still things you can do. Just don't be the person who signs up to sit in the muck.
Yeah.
You might be the person who signs up and just goes and mows their lawn on a Saturday when they're not home. You might be the person who drops off a gift card for a local restaurant that delivers. You might be the person who, you know, has a carpool for school and could take their kids to and from school and relieve them of that one parental duty. There are a number of helpful things that can be done that don't include being in the emotional muck, but can provide the support and solace that people so desperately need and they don't even know they need. So the endless question, what can I do? Call me if I can do anything, is so challenging for widowed people and for grieving people in general because we don't know what we need.
Right.
And so when you say, call me if you need something, I think I have no, first of all, one, I have no idea what I need. And secondly, how would I know if you're going to be the person who could give me? What if I need someone who's going to, you know, take me to the hospital in the middle of the night because two kids are sleeping and one has a high fever and I've got to take them to the hospital? Is that you? Like, are you that person? Because what you said to me was, call me anytime. Uh-huh. But if you are a person who could be the, I call that the 3 a.m. person, because, you know, when I was widowed at home with three kids, my family did not live nearby. So I was an hour and a half from any of my family members. Who did I call at 3 o'clock in the morning that would come sit with the other two kids? So I didn't have to bundle three kids out of bed and go to the urgent care.
Yeah.
So I always ask people, if you're that person, say, I'm the person who could call at 3 in the morning if your pipes burst and you need some help, you know, with a bucket. I'm the person you can call. Please never hesitate to do that. Now, when something happens in the middle of the night, I think, oh, my friend Joanne told me that I could call anytime, night or day. Mm-hmm. Now I know that's the person I call.
Yeah.
So it can be very specific about what you're offering, and if you can refrain from encouraging people to process quickly or to appear normal or fixed, or, you know, that they have found their way, you're going to go a long ways towards helping.
Yeah, I love your take on that. I learned the hard way in the hospice work that I did, and also with personal relationships, that some people will call me or message me because they know the hospice background. They say, hey, so-and-so is dying, or they lost a loved one, and I don't know what to tell them. And what I came to understand is the best thing we can do is just be present, because everyone wants to be seen, everyone wants to be heard, and only love is really safe enough to come out to. And that takes the pressure off of you then, doesn't it, when you're that friend?
Yeah, it really does. And also, one of the things that I tell people consistently, because we often will have people reach out and say, you know, I know a widowed person, I'd really like to connect them with you. And I always tell them, I want you to know that your love matters. Mm-hmm. And it might not feel like you've done anything at all, but the fact that you're reaching out on their behalf, the fact that you want to be present for them, the fact that you clearly love them, that will matter. And more than any other thing you can do, finding expressions of love matters.
Ah, I love that. That's a bumper sticker right there.
Yes, let's make it.
Okay. How does connecting with a community of others who are going through profound loss help someone? Because I'm sure you've had people say to you, oh, that sounds so negative, that'll just bring me down.
For sure. I've had people say, what do you do at a conference for widowed people? Do you cry the whole time? And because we call it Camp Widow, somebody else asked me, do you sing Kumbaya? we've gotten this question a lot. And I'll say, you know, there's a threefold value in processing in community. The first is perspective. If I come to a community and I say, you know, I haven't been able to sleep in my bed, and I think I'm completely crazy because I can't sleep in my bed, and I'm afraid to even say that to anybody else because they're going to be like, why not? You're a big, you know, you're a big girl now. You should be able to sleep in your bed. Mm-hmm. But when I go to a place where other people are grieving, and I like at Camp Widow, when we are having conversations, someone will say, I can't sleep in my bed. Someone else says, me either. Someone else says, I sleep on the couch. Someone else says, oh my gosh, are you kidding? I've been sleeping on my bed the whole time. I don't even leave my room. Like, just be able to get perspective helps you understand that there's a million different ways to grieve. And as long as you're not hurting yourself or others, there's no right way.
Yeah.
So it is really wonderful to have a community support for that reason. The second piece is that we witness for each other. And so one of the things that you most miss, especially for in the widowed experience, is this person who was witnessing life with you, experiencing life side by side. They're the ones who say, hey, remember we went to dinner, you know, at that place, it's that place. And they're like, you know, they're the person who knows what that place is. And so suddenly you find yourself without kind of that historical memory. And so to have other people witness, just the other day I was told of a group of widowed people who went and watched one of their fellow widowed persons in a play. And, you know, they all went to support her, and she had people to witness for her who understood that the one person who was missing, who would have been so proud of her, who would have been in the audience, couldn't be, and so they were there for her instead. Mm. And that's another really beautiful thing about community, is that you begin to build relationships where you can provide that witness for each other in such a unique and powerful way. There's one more. The last one is that as we continue to heal, and we look better and better, you know, from the outside, how people start saying, gosh, you know, you look like your life's coming together. You know, Michelle, you got your organization up and going. That's great. Wow, you have a book out in the world. That's great. That doesn't mean I'm not going to grieve Phil in a new way tomorrow. And when I have a widowed community or a community of people who are walking through a similar thing as you are, then you know where to go when you need a little pick-me-up. You know where to go where it's okay that you're not done, that you're not healed, that you don't have your healing stamp, your healed stamp on your head that says, okay, you can be done with that now. It's a place to return to every time you need some additional support. And I think that that becomes more and more important the further out we get from our experiences, because people forget, of course, because it looks like you're fine. You're just out doing your thing, living your life. And yet in the background of that is still the grief that you carry or the influences that your trauma has had on you. And being able to have a community that uniquely understands that provides that respite and allows you to just keep on healing forward. Mm.
Well, over the years, you have worked with thousands of widowed people from around the world. I'm wondering, can you share with us a story, someone's story of healing that's had a great impact on you?
Yes. Oh, gosh. I have been so privileged to be a part of so many different widowed people's experiences. But one in particular that comes to mind is a young woman who was in the hospital giving birth to her child after her young husband's sudden death. Hmm. And she was talking to the social worker because, of course, the medical team became aware that she was widowed and that there was not going to be a father present. Mm-hmm. And so she had a different support person. And the social worker basically just said, was, of course, heartbroken for her, didn't know what to do for her. And so her sister reached out to us and said, you know, I am sitting in my sister's hospital room looking for resources for her because it has become clear to me that nobody quite knows what to do with her. Hmm. And so in that moment, she was able to connect with a community through Soaring Spirits of other widowed people who were pregnant when their person died. We were able to provide resources for the social worker so that the social worker could continue moving through and having additional resources, which were definitely going to help her because she felt terrible that she didn't know where to send this person for help.
Yeah.
But the most beautiful part is that she connected with other widows who are raising babies who don't know, have any of their own memories of their father. And I recently heard that they have had a play group. And so, you know, imagine the beauty of being in a collective community where now they're all starting to rebuild their lives. They're all figuring out what's going to be next for them. Do they stay in the home where they were? Do they stay in the city they were? You know, what do they want for their lives in this new iteration, knowing what they know now about themselves? But within that, they have this unique community of people who all gave birth to a child after the death of their husband or partner.
Oh.
And are raising these kids and talking. I mean, they get to have conversations about how do you keep his memory alive? Like, what do we do about his birthday?
Yeah.
Do you have a photo book? Like, how do you do that? It's just such a beautiful experience to heal in community because then now you've got your people.
Yes.
And I could not be more grateful for that little group of people who happened to be nearby each other, were able to meet in person, have this little play group. And you know what? If they're out on a playground, nobody has any idea what their connection is.
Mm-hmm.
They look like just a regular old group of moms taking care of these littles. So it's really just a beautiful, it's just so beautiful. I love that they have each other and I love the way they support each other. And,
Yeah. You
know, I think that it's a gift of community that speaks to me over and over again.
And a connection at such a deep level, too, because of what they all went through.
Yeah.
Let's
yeah.
talk a little bit about your amazing nonprofit foundation, Soaring Spirits International. You offer a variety of programs and services. For our listeners, can you share a little bit about what some of those are?
Yes, I would love to. Soaring Spirits provides in-person and virtual programs for widowed people around the world. Our intention is to help widowed people rebuild their lives after the death of their spouse or partner. We use a very inclusive definition of the word widowed. So if the person you thought you were going to spend your life with died, Mm-hmm. We consider you widowed, and you're welcome in our programs. Those programs include in-person weekend-long events, which you've heard me mention, called Camp Widow. Mm-hmm. They can be a weekend-long event, which is kind of a cross between a conference, a retreat, and a high school reunion, because people come back and for their community. They come back to be a part of it, and to eventually they come back to give back. So it's a very beautiful thing. So Camp Widow is a weekend-long. We also have what we call Camp Widow Pop-Ups, which is a one-day kind of mini camp that travels the U.S. We have four locations for Camp Widow right now: San Diego, California; Tampa, Florida; Brisbane, Australia; and Toronto, Canada.
Wow.
That's yeah, amazing. And they're just so beautiful. It works in every culture, in every space. When you bring people together in community, they support each other. It is really beautiful.
The foreword of your book was written by Kristen Carlson. And, you know, I saw the name, then I read through, and I said, oh, yeah, she was the wife of Richard Carlson. I had all his books.
Yeah.
But you had her speak, I guess, at one of your camps, one of your functions.
We did. She came and spoke at Camp Widow in San Diego, and was just, she's such a beautiful light. And, you know, as you said, she is the widow of Dr. Richard Carlson. And it was just such a crazy full circle to realize, when I was raising my little babies, I had Don't Sweat the Small Stuff for Families. And so when I met Christine, I was introduced to Christine through the widowed experience. Mm-hmm. Her husband died just after mine.
Yeah.
And so we have this shared community, and we're introduced through that. And I just thought, when I got the copy of my book and her name was on the front, I thought, what a full circle. And no world would I have imagined that we would not only have the opportunity to work together, but become friends.
Yeah.
And for her to have a pivotal role in this book being out in the world is just really a gift.
So I have to ask you, Michelle, what was it like being chosen 2021 CNN Hero? That's a big deal.
It was surreal. it was just, especially because the beautiful thing about the CNN Heroes program is that you're never going to meet a group of people who are more passionate about what they do.
Yeah.
And so coming together in that group of people and being able to hear each of them passionately speak to the cause they support was so cool. And it raises your hopes for humanity when you realize there are people out there every day working on behalf of others, working to make the world a better place. And CNN Heroes is just a culmination of that. It was an honor to be on the stage with the people who were there. It was a gift to our organization to be able to get the word out about the programs that we offer, especially because so many people have been impacted by COVID and become, I think, more aware of the grief experience because we're all having such a different level of grief going around the world, let alone our own individual grief, our community grief. You know, we are carrying these on such a different level. And so it seemed that it was the perfect time for us to be able to highlight grief on that international stage.
Well, to my listeners, if you have gone through loss, if you know someone who's gone through loss, I highly recommend this new book, Different After You, Rediscovering Yourself and Healing After Grief and Trauma. The author is Michelle Neff Hernandez. She's also the creator of Camp Widow. And Michelle, for more information, can you share your web address, please?
For more information on Soaring Spirits, you can go to soaringspirits.org. And for all things book-related or just to contact me directly, my website is Michelle with one L, neffhernandez.com.
Ah, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and also for the gift of this book to so many people around the world. Thank you for the light and love that you're sharing.
It's an honor to be here. Thank you so much for sharing.
Once again, the book is Different After You, Rediscovering Yourself and Healing After Grief and Trauma. And the author is Michelle Neff, N-E-F-F, Hernandez. And it's under her name, her website, that you can find more information, michellenefhernandez.com. And that's today's program. I want to thank you so much for joining me. I want a reminder that all shows are podcast on the site. And so for engineer Genesis Brown and occasionally Kylan Talley and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're bringing love to life, one broadcast at a time.